What we're going to do tonight is we're not going to give remarks at the podium. We're just going to engage in a conversation among the three of us that will then open up to a conversation with all of you. It's not just because the Perpetual Peace Project is a dialogic one. It's also because, in a certain sense, this project began as a conversation among the three of us at a coffee table in New York. And that was about 2 years ago. And we were interested in the question of how Kant's essay from 1795 on perpetual peace would not be an essay that we would simply repudiate or endorse, but how it could generate a practice of engagement and a process. And we thought at great length about how a project could be generated around a text and how the text could become the basis for kind of a methodology. And so tonight we're going to share with you some of the ways that that project has played out, some of the ways this process has manifested itself, but also, I think, in the conversational format, some of the tensions and the different ways we're thinking about it as we move forward. I'm going to, as in addition to being the innkeeper tonight, I'm also going to speak as a curator. Greg is going to speak, I think, as a philosopher in a way that he is. And Martin will speak maybe in a more diplomatic kind of context. As a curator, I'm fundamentally interested in the ways that a project doesn't just begin and end in 30 days or in 60 days, but in the way that it can take the form of a process that's ongoing, that entails ongoing responsibilities. And so as a curator, as this project started to emerge, I was interested in the way that it would entail responsibilities on my part, and that it would be ongoing, that I'd have to kind of think about how it could be not just a one-time event or occasion. I'm also interested in the question of curiosity. I'm not a political scientist. I have no previous kind of relationship to peace except a marked interest or curiosity about what it means, how it is defined by practitioners today, be those philosophers or statesmen. And so for me, the project, in a way, has been an opportunity to think about this issue and to learn about this issue, not beginning from a position of complete knowledge or authority, but rather out of curiosity. And then third, as I mentioned, I'm fundamentally interested in the notion of what it would mean to be engaged today, and how one does not just read a text, but how one can deduce from it methodologies for practice. So we live in a very disorienting moment. Peace and war and violence are braided together more often than not in a very complex and intertwined way. As I'm sure you all know, Obama recently kind of invoked Afghanistan as a just war in the name of peace. And this is something that we can talk about at great length tonight, and it's something that the three of us have talked about at great length. But peace and violence and war are fundamentally kind of intertwined in a way that can be sometimes disorienting. Orwell famously remarked that peace and war are the same thing today. So one of the ways that this project began was kind of simply on a linguistic level. We were trying to think about how peace functions terminologically, how people are defining it, and what other ways it could be defined, perhaps more archaic ways, as Greg was talking recently to my students at Penn, some of whom are here tonight, earlier today, how we could recover some of these kind of lost etymological associations of peace as a relationship, not just as a contract. The images that you see behind us are by a German photographer, Armin Linke. He spent some time sociologically studying the United Nations, following Kofi Annan and others around as they did the business of peace. We tend to associate today peace with the United Nations and with large international institutions. The Perpetual Peace Project begins, though, from the understanding that the United Nations or any individual or institution can never own or master the concept of peace. And Greg's going to speak about that shortly. So as much as we may define peace institutionally today, I think as Kant himself struggles with in Perpetual Peace, there's also the possibility to think about it in relationship to one's home and to questions of hospitality, the way that one engages with strangers on a more intimate and personal level. So we began by going back to the text of Perpetual Peace from 1795. I don't read German, although Martin and Greg do, so for me, first and foremost, the project was about translation from the very beginning. I was reading peace or Kant's ideas of peace in translation. We began not just by reading this text, but by republishing it. And so James and Israel and Alex and others may be able to show you, and you may have already gotten copies of them, kind of a beautiful book that a graphic design firm collaborated with us on, reprinting Kant's text in the French fold tradition of Kant's time. So the pages are sealed the text itself, Lacan's text, is on the inside of the sealed pages. You have to kind of perforate the book. You have to perforate the pages to access the text within. The text always kind of interspersed with blank pages of spaces of breathing and of writing. So we began just by going back to the text and trying to find in the text principles that could become the basis for the project. One that's particularly dear to me is this kind of emergent idea of cosmopolitanism that Kant introduces. The social relations between the various peoples of the world in narrower or wider circles have now advanced everywhere so far that a violation of right in one place of the earth is felt all over it. I was interested personally, and I think the three of us have been interested in that concept, and again, how it could translate today, how we could read that in terms of contemporary geopolitics. We began as well by filming with two filmmakers. Greg and I started to approach, with Martin's amazing introductions, a variety of practitioners. Sorry that it's a little bit dark, but I'm going to narrate. Ed Luck, a special advisor to Ban Ki-moon, who's responsible for the responsibility to protect mandate at the UN. We filmed him. He talked about how peace and change have to be understood on the level of decades, not as something that one oneself gets to witness, you know, as in the art community or in academia we often want the case to be. We filmed Gerard Araud, a member of the Security Council at the UN, right after the Gaza flotilla incident, a few hours actually after his public remarks. We filmed a counterterrorism expert, William Banks, at Syracuse. And we filmed a variety of other practitioners. We filmed Len Cixous, who Israel mentioned, Kwame Appiah, Saskia Sassen, a sociologist, Achille Mbembe, a Johannesburg-based theorist. And the list goes on. And tonight we may, depending on how much time we have, play one short segment. But in fact, so much of this material is already in the targets that are dispersed throughout the campus. And you can find this also online as well. As the project evolved and moved forward, questions of translation and cultural difference came to the fore as crucial questions. I undertook workshops in Pakistan in September with a variety of students, artists, architects, and activists at a number of institutions in Lahore. Those are recordings that you can access on the website. And as Lyndon mentioned, these have also now played out in other countries and cities. They'll be playing out here tomorrow, 2 weeks ago in Tijuana and San Isidro and San Diego. So this is a conversation. This is a project that's dialogic, and it takes form through, it finds its public forum through a conversational format, and that is an ongoing project. And then I'm going to quickly just close by talking about the exhibition components. Clearly at Haverford now you have a new instantiation of that. A few months ago, back in October, we opened the project at the New Museum in New York. They'd invited us in to work with them. And what we wanted to do is work with the ancillary and circulation spaces of the museum, not the galleries per se, but rather the spaces that people move in. We wanted to reclaim those spaces as spaces of dialogue. And so those media targets that are dispersed now throughout your campus were dispersed on different floors of the museum, in the staircases, by the elevators. And then a blue rug, which is now at Slott Foundation, where we have a corollary project to this one, was the site of a variety of lectures and intimate conversations. We had a consul general from Slovenia, we had Greg Lambert, we had a variety of practitioners and statesmen negotiating and thinking in dialogue with others about peace. And we're interested in, fundamentally, and I think maybe this is something that Greg will maybe want to speak about, the ways that institutions often frame the way we think about concepts, such as peace, but any concept. And so we had a number of seating arrangements. These are just kind of the schematics we developed to think about the different ways we could engage in a conversation and the different ways that format, that schematic, might kind of produce the different kind of concepts that could emerge, the different conversations that could emerge from the different ways we choreograph the conversation. And so these are just some of the pictures that give you kind of a sense of how that played out. There is a somewhat corporate feel to the visual language of these targets. At the New Museum, you know, it's a museum that began in the 70s with a very political sensibility and practice of engagement. Today, it's a large institution that navigates other tensions. And so we had to figure out the language for the project that would fit within that institution And in each institution, the conversation plays out differently, finding different visual forms and different, you know, schematic arrangements. And so here's the map for here at Haverford. And you can either encounter these targets casually, informally, by chance, or you can seek them out. So I am going to stop there, and I'm going to let Martin take over.
Well, thank you, Aaron. And I would just like to start by reminding you why Aaron is the innkeeper and why we are the theoretical and the practical politicians. I mean, the opening paragraph of the text, which I'm sure you've all read, talks about this Dutch innkeeper who has the sign of perpetual peace on his restaurant, which in the original German version actually doesn't say perpetual peace, it says eternal peace. And therefore there's a little image of a graveyard there. So Kant, who was really not known for being a very funny, humorous philosopher, actually starts out this text for a philosopher, I would say, rather humorous way, and points out to something which then goes throughout the text and has fascinated me, this dichotomy or this difference between theory and practice, which I can also see in my own career, in my own short career so far. I've started out studying philosophy at the University of Vienna, wrote my thesis on a contemporary of Immanuel Kant. Then I was a reporter on foreign issues in Austria, in my home country, covering a number of international conflicts in the 90s. And then I entered the Foreign Service at the beginning of 2000. And for me, it was a cultural shock to be in this world. And I remember that some of the older colleagues, when in a discussion, they would say, well, this sounds a bit like a philosophical question. They actually meant this sounds a bit like a silly question. Or philosophers, some of our colleagues, they had the nicknames that they were philosophers, which meant that they were talking senselessly about things. And I thought this was a very interesting thing, having studied philosophy, to look at the reputation. And Kant makes a reference to this reputation at his time in the late 18th century. So for me, when we started out with this project of bringing together theoreticians and practitioners, I was, of course, most interested in bringing my colleagues to the table and having them read the text. I suspect for the first time. They, of course, all said that they had read it many, many times when we confronted them with this project. And they were very excited about it. There were many ambassadors at the United Nations in New York whom we got involved in the project. And I think what was the excitement for them? In New York, of course, is a very interesting city. It is the head of the United Nations and is also the head of the United Nations Security Council, which is the one body in theory that is kind of deciding on international conflicts with a huge legal and therefore political and moral authority, at least in theory. And so they have all these people there who are dealing with practical conflicts on a daily basis, and yet they do not reflect on the terms, on the language they use, and on the idea and on the main goal, what it is all about peace, what is really peace. And so for them, I think it was, and they confirmed it to us, a very interesting idea to get involved and to step back from the daily affairs and to read this text, discover what is relevant for them today, and there's actually quite a lot, and then to engage in a discussion with people from completely different fields, international law experts, experts of international relations, and philosophers, intellectuals, artists, and this is what we really tried to initiate, a dialogue between all these people, and we had a number of institutions participating. It was originally a project. Austria, as you know, is a small country member of the European Union, and so we engaged other countries of the European Union who are collectively in a network of European cultural institutes in New York, and we also engaged the United Nations itself. We had a workshop in November at the International Peace Institute, which is a very interesting institution right next to the UN headquarters, and it is it's actually something like a think tank, but also a space where diplomats usually meet secretly to talk about things they cannot officially talk. So particularly when you think of countries in the Middle East that do not even have diplomatic relations with each other, New York is an ideal place because almost everybody is member of the United Nations, so the people are all there and they can meet and hold talks which they cannot do officially. And so we used this space to have an event, a one-day workshop at the International Peace Institute, where ambassadors from different countries would engage in this dialogue. For me, the conclusion, I think the most interesting thing was that you could really see when you would see these people from different fields talking with each other, diplomats, philosophers, thinkers, practitioners, that they would all be used to talk in their own jargon, use their own language, use their own terms. Some wouldn't really use the word peace. They would use more abstract concepts of non-violence or absence of conflicts. And they had to find a common language and a common ground in this workshop. And I think the interesting thing is that Kant, Immanuel Kant himself, sees this as one of the necessary conditions to establish a perpetual peace, is to establish such a dialogue where he thinks, in particular, also the thinkers need to be heard and need to just be let to speak, and that would in itself create one of the necessary conditions of peace. And I think this is what attracted me from the very beginning about this project, to bring people from very diverse fields together and to talk about a text from 1795. And I think if we think of the initiative so far, to discover that in many ways a very relevant text.
Thank you and good evening. I'm very happy to be here, and it's kind of ironic that that the three of us are back at a table, like in an inn again, talking about this text, and in some way it was the commencement of the project. But let me try to outline some of the specific, to follow what Martin has said, the splitting of the sense of theoretical and practical. Is the practical is embodied in practice, in reality, in institutions, and is given an immediate sense of reality. And in some ways, the theoretical is oftentimes dismissed because it's more distant, more abstract, more in the sense academic. And these are the two. This is the two senses that have been split between the two bases of knowledge, between the philosopher and the legal analyst, or the philosopher and the political theorist, or the diplomatic. This is at the core. This tension is at the core of the beginning of Kant's text, and it's something that we came back to many times to think about bringing together both of these subjects together at this time would be very important for one principal reason, is that for each subject, the practical politician, particularly the diplomat, the legal theorist, those that deal with the practical issues of security and peacekeeping, as well as nonviolence on a daily basis, and our contemporary theorists today, very seldom use the word peace. And this became one of the first, I'd say, it became, I think, a moment of acknowledgement and reflection on all of our parts, that peace. In context himself says that the practical politician cannot publicly utilize the word peace without fearing being dismissed and laughed at. In other words, that to invest in an idea of peace, that is, in the philosophical idea of peace, or in the idea of a permanent or an eternal peace is not something one can practically do and maintain one's position in the world of politics. At the same time, this colors then or determines the way that the philosophical discourse is immediately seems to be abstract, silly, it's dismissed out of hand. In the same way that the concept of peace, when you consider it, if you really take it seriously, immediately the objections enter in. When someone says peace in a room, immediately people begin to argue, in a sense, why it's not possible, or why it's not really practical, or why it's not realistic, or why in a certain way that you're a dreamer, you're dreaming of another world. I think that one of the things that we wanted to reflect on is the way that, those meanings, in a contemporary sense, have split the concept itself apart into very different institutions. So each of us in some ways represent a kind of institutional practice or personality. And this project has made us all performatively enact that. And Aaron is the curatorial practice of staging and of thinking about this as an ongoing initiative and a conversation. And so I'll talk for a minute about the problems and about the kind of initiatives that we undertook and why. Martin, you know, understands and deals with it on a daily basis, the practical and the very problematic ways in which peace is discussed within the context of security concerns, issues within the diplomatic community, issues that have real effects, people dying, people starving, and so forth. And then there's the academic, theoretical discourse, too, that in some way I'm supposed to emblematize and perform or enact. What I found interesting in my own field is that most of the theorists at this particular moment today are mostly talking about war and security. In other words, if you think about theorists like Badiou and Zizek or you may not even know these theorists, but you think of contemporary philosophers, even the philosophers today have in some way abandoned the concept of peace as unrealistic or impossible. And they're the first to say that peace is war. In other words, that there is no difference. So I think that one of the things, even in terms of a naivete, that we wanted to open up this question again in a few very important ways. One is, to claim, and this I'll talk about the principles that we devised at a very critical moment of this project. Why did this project take on so many different kinds of initiatives and forms? One is that it was the belief that a cultural initiative, a diplomatic or bringing together within the institution of the UN, a meeting between philosophers and practitioners or philosophers and diplomats was itself to engage or stage a peace movement within that institution. How would we conceive today of a peace movement? It wouldn't be in the 60s or the 70s style popular movement of hitting the streets, because in a certain way, even that notion or convention, it wouldn't be starting a completely different community in the religious sense or spiritual tradition. We found ourselves embedded and institutionalized in some ways, and the only way to begin this process is through constant translation of questioning our own practices and trying to find ways to create, to stage practices or a conversation, as Aaron says, about peace within another context. Now, one of the things that Kant highlights is the notion of publicity. That is, the very notion or the very talking about peace is itself an event. And when you talk about peace in a different way, in a different kind of institution, you have the opportunity of causing people to think about it, causing people to begin to reflect on it. If you talk about it, let's say, in a curatorial exhibit in a museum, if peace is on every wall or in every passage, as Aaron talked about, you walk through the stairway going from one floor to the other, and you run into an exhibit on peace. On this campus now, the visual diagram of all of the targets on the campus, that people are going to be bumping into the concept of the word peace on a daily basis in a way that is unusual or not habitual. And in some ways, it will cause people to think or reflect on the concept not only in terms of what it means to them, but in terms of how it's determined by this institution or by the academic institution about where you are, but also about the very place that you're at in Philadelphia, the region, the United States, what is peace for the United States globally. All of those things are things that we hope that in different instantiations of these different initiatives cause people to think and reflect on it. That also meant going to the UN and staging, in some ways, a provocative sort of event and asking them, well, why don't you read this text that that now is in the past, historical, even dated in some ways, that doesn't have any relevance. And then we found that there was an intense interest on the part of many of the diplomats and a curiosity. The one shocking thing that we heard was that I don't really think about peace in that sense much in my daily job. And so you would think that in the UN, that would be the first thing that they would think about morning, noon, and night. And in the academic sense, it's to raise the issue of why peace as a concept is fated to become, as Kant talked about, abstract and immediately dismissed or immediately negated. And that's something that to stage, in a sense, a peace movement within an academic context is to cause a different way, maybe a curatorial engagement, a way of thinking about it in a way that it's not normally habitually just simply scholarship or something of the past, but something actively that you need to think and confront about in your life today. The last thing I'll say is that Aaron and I went to, actually, we went on several pilgrimages. Aaron has actually been on many more pilgrimages than I have. He's recently been, as he talked about, to Lahore, to Beijing, also to Hong Kong, engaging in new initiatives just like the one that will begin tomorrow, the workshops here at Haverford. The idea is that the publicity of peace must constantly expand. It can never stop moving. And that's one of the senses of perpetual, in a sense not of eternal, but of a perpetual motion machine. In one way, this curatorial, the surprising thing about this, and this is something that Haverford has really actualized too, is that it seems that whoever hears about this project wants to become involved in it. And we didn't plan all of these initiatives, and in certain ways, these occurred through people really engaging and thinking about their institutions and wanting to bring this kind of project and this kind of event and to make it different as well, to create something different according to the space. Aaron and I went to Geneva last year on a pilgrimage of sorts, and it was partly to film some of the segments of a film segment. Maybe we could show that just in a minute before we break into a larger conversation. Also, the film initiative was a way of bringing together philosophers and theorists and practitioners in a virtual space because we knew we would never be able to get them in the same room. And so it was the film became a mechanism of making a conversation happen when it couldn't happen in real time. At the end of our trip to Geneva, where we went to the United Nations to participate in a human rights conference last spring, we came to a kind of crisis of asking ourselves, what are we doing? Or what do we think we're doing? And so in some ways, also taking into account all of the fact that the project had expanded, it had become a part of the cultural initiative at the museum, the new museum, the IPI, which is the UN, United Nations. We have several academic sort of events as well as the workshops. So we devised, with that in mind, these different principles to try to understand the project. So I'll just kind of run through these principles and we could each maybe talk about them from each of our experiences. First, the Perpetual Peace Project is predicated on the belief that no one institution or individual can clearly claim or guarantee a mastery of the concept of peace, be it the concept has a legal meaning that today has a large reality and determination of what its reality is, but it also has a spiritual and religious meaning. It is also, as Aaron talked about, etymologically related to the very notion of greeting, aloha, shalom. In other words, peace is what you say to someone in the initial moment of contact to say that you are not engaged in hostility. In other words, it is a sign not of recognition of between members of a community necessarily all the time, but a sign of welcoming the stranger, and that's why it's really much related to hospitality. The second is that peace continues to be defined negatively in the absence of war, and this is what Kant critiques. If we define peace negatively only, then we have no understanding of its positive sense. Third, the project is not attempting to actively formulate a public policy. Now, you can see we were constantly running into a crisis that people thought we were trying to propose a new policy concerning peace, when in fact what we were trying to do is engage in a peace movement in different kinds of institutions today. The fourth is the project can be understood through Kant's notion of publicity as many forms. And five, eventually this conversation must include everyone, since no one can claim to have absolute knowledge concerning what the idea of peace is. So, you want to go back to conclude, or do we want to go?
No. I don't think we're done yet. I think I just kind of want to engage in a couple of pointed questions with you. I mean, probably you have the sense that we're all thinking very much in alike and in parallel. And over the last 2 years, we've also been really thinking through a number of kind of tensions or questions. So I don't know which one to kind of bring up or how to kind of get started, so to speak. But maybe the question of like what failure would mean to you, what success would mean to you. This is a project which poses, at least on one level, an impossible aspiration. Like, for instance, I know that at the event at the International Peace Institute, we had very fundamentally different readings of how one could gauge its success or failure, what exactly happened that day in trying to enact Kant's secret article where he proposes a conversation between the philosopher and the statesman. So I guess maybe that would be something that would bring out that difference or that tension.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the question about failure or success of the project, I mean, there are many ways of speaking about peace. And if I think back of my colleagues at the foreign ministry and when they talk about philosophical debates, they of course mean in a sense some sort of ingenuous, naive kind of way of talking about a peace, for example, in an unrealistic way, trying to attempt goals that cannot be achieved. And if you look at this text of Kant, and which is something they then did, there is actually no naivete in it at all. I mean, Kant, and I think that makes this text so attractive even today. Did not just write an essay contemplating the idea of peace. He is also a very systematic philosopher, trying to understand the entire world. And this idea of peace is just fits very well into an entire philosophy of human understanding. And therefore, for him, I think peace is for him a fundamental a principle that actually kind of makes the issue of theory and practice more understandable. For him, there is no difference between theoretical debates and practical debates. In this text, he, for example, discusses the possibility of whether politicians have a different kind of morality than normal people have, and he says no, they don't. I think what Kant really insists on that what works theoretically also must work practically, and he is not naive in thinking that since human beings are anyway good, in the end peace will be achieved. He has actually a very pessimistic outlook on human nature, but he says that he in the end thinks that peace will be achieved because of the mechanisms of what he calls nature and providence, which I think are very mysterious concepts and for me this is of course one of the most interesting, maybe also most controversial parts. Why are we hoping for peace, and what kind of arguments do we have for peace? Success or failure, I think, obviously when practitioners talk with theoreticians about peace, the result is not going to be world peace. But I think starting a process where people reflect on the work they are doing, I think, and notice and maybe actually will fail in their dialogue is actually the success. I think that this project has been achieving that you really could bring people out of their world and out of their jargon and out of their language and reflect on what they are doing. And that I see the success, not necessarily on coming with new insights about what really peace is about.
Yeah, what Aaron's talking about, there's a part of Kant's text that is very, it's funny and it's also very odd. The very first article of Kant's text, he says that there should never be a secret article or clause in any treaty. Now, Kant writes his text in the form of a peace treaty. And then he concludes with a few appendices. One is a secret article that he puts in his treaty. So he contradicts himself. But it's a fabulous secret article. It says that politicians, or practical politicians, or diplomats, or the statesmen, should at least consider privately the philosopher's idea of peace, even while they are preparing for war. Now, this is an amazing statement. At one level, he's accepting the fact that the world is entering into a stage, and he was talking about precisely a stage of Europe in a period of enormous, intense war. The Napoleonic Wars were occurring during this period. That he knew that war was inevitable, and that in fact all discussions of peace, that political strategists would, I mean, in a sense, peace would be used in a strategic sense only to further the interests of nations and so forth. But he was trying to preserve the idea of peace by making a compromise, and a sort of, to make peace something that at least the politician would consider privately, in their private life. So to return to what Martin said, and also to respond to what Aaron said, I don't think there was an attempt. We had tried, as one of our initiatives, to stage the secret article in the UN. That was one of the overt intentions, was to get philosophers and ambassadors and diplomats of the United Nations at a table in secret in the UN to really consider seriously have a dialogue about peace. And in some ways that initiative failed, because one cannot, in a sense, bring one subject like the philosopher into another institution, a legal institution, and immediately expect recognition, and that the discursive frameworks would be the same, that our language would be the same, or that our, in a sense, the notion of recognition would function in the same way. And yet, it was very ironic that the event succeeded, amazingly, to fulfill the very conditions of the secret article. It caused, in a sense, the very nature of the event caused the practical politicians, the legal theorists, to, in a sense, at least consider the idea of the philosopher, even though it was, in a sense, in a framework that was not familiar to them. And in some ways, I think that I'll just end by saying what Martin said. Something can only be a failure if it is the last instance. And if our project or this initiative is one that is an ongoing or perpetual initiative, that we will, I think at one point, once we recover we had some differences about how we evaluated the initiative, but then in the end, I think that I came to an understanding of that in some ways it was just the beginning of a process, that we would come at it again in a different way to try to stage. It was just the fact that a cultural initiative that most people, you would think that most politicians or the United Nations would not see its interest in being involved in a cultural initiative organized by the Slot Foundation or the Syracuse Humanities Center. First of all, these are institutions that don't have the stature of the United Nations. We're not coming from Columbia or Princeton or other universities or other organizations or art organizations or cultural organizations that they would be, in a sense, desire to be in the same room with. But in fact, it was the nature of the project that interested them, that brought them to the table. And in some way, it was the very involvement or participation that was so amazing about that event. And I think that that's why even though it failed to create a transparent dialogue between legal theorists and philosophers, in some way that's because that dialogue is historical and may not take place for hundreds of years.
in the process of thinking about this project and being engaged in it and trying to move it forward as a curator, I also started to come, in a way, try to rethink how I could enact that secret article. And I think that one of the things that was very interesting is I think Greg wanted to hold, maybe, I don't mean this in a critical way, more literally to that earlier idea of a conversation between the philosopher and the statesman. And I wanted to immediately have an expanded definition emerge of what a philosopher might be, what a statesman might be. And so for me, I was particularly interested in kind of moving beyond the disciplinary confrontation or conversation between those two. So at IPI, we were also, I think, kind of in a way, thinking about or struggling over amongst ourselves kind of these two ways of thinking about how you remain true to the text. Do you, like, kind of literally stay true to the text, to Kant's kind of secret article, as Greg so eloquently spoke about it, or do you kind of, in a way, start to redefine it and play with it? With the IPI event, I kind of wasn't even, I mean, in a certain sense, the event meant a great deal to me. I spent every day for a year working on it. But at the same time, I wasn't so much interested in what was going to happen in that particular moment, that particular day, but rather how it might make possible a more comfortable space, a space in which diplomats, philosophers, and others might see in the IPI, in the Peace Institute, kind of a space that could be a space for talking about a historical text, that could be a space for talking abstractly, that could be a space of talking across disciplines. So I was less interested in evaluating whether that event succeeded or not in terms of the participants who were part of it solely. I was equally or more interested in thinking about to what degree was it productive for IPI, to what degree within that institution did they find in it kind of a possibility, a practice, a methodology that could be continued. Right? So if that's the last time that the IPI undertakes a project like that, in a certain sense, I would say that, in fact, we've failed. We may have succeeded in a dialogic encounter between individuals in choreographing that, but in a certain sense, what I'm fundamentally interested in is what happens at IPI and at the UN in the years ahead, and the possibility for this kind of an intimate conversation to continue. And so the same thing would be said about this project at Haverford. If this project at Haverford is like this incredibly playful, insightful, subtle collaboration across the various centers and departments and faculty and students here, if it's all that, but then it kind of abruptly ends in 2 months and doesn't necessarily leave traces and further practices in its wake, then I would, in a way, be concerned. And to the degree that it starts to generate other things, in the way that what kind of makes a great exhibition event generated this, like, if it acts more like that and it leads to other things, then I would say it succeeded. It's just an ongoing process. It's kind of a constant process that needs to continue.
The IPI event, by the way, I mean, I'm sure Aaron has talked about, or the instructors, you can listen to many portions, to all portions of that on the website. One of the things that we've tried to do is every one of the initiatives, the multiple initiatives, is archived in a way so that it becomes part of the record or part of the way, the trace that you can follow. But it would be interesting to see what, I mean, particularly with students, the interest in this would be that in some way that you engage in the idea in your own context and in your own study as well.
I would like to also maybe come to one fundamental question, and is why could such a text really be interesting for current political affairs, current political conflicts? And if you just think what is going on, for example, right now, in one of the most conflictuous and contentious areas of the world, in the Middle East, what is going on in these hours in Egypt, for example, then I think you have one of these moments where all these people we've been talking about, the politicians, the thinkers, the diplomats, have at least in the last days been thrown out of their usual way of thinking because of the events that have been happening there. And I would like to have the IPI workshop now, and have everybody talk about what's going on in Egypt, because there I think you really have, everybody's challenged. Yeah, everybody's challenged with one's usual way of thinking about the Middle East and thinking about democracy. And you can see that there's confusion, that people are not sure what to say. Not only Sarah Palin, I think everybody has been kind of uneasy how to touch this kind of issue. Yeah, is democracy a good thing? Is it is it serving the peace in the Middle East? I think even within the West, we are not sure.
Yeah.
And I think there you could really take Kant, yeah, and look at his distinctions and his very cautious approach to this idea that, according to him, you need a representative republicanism, as he defines it, a republic, in order to guarantee peace. And I think this another moment, for example, this issue of transparency and publicity. We've had this lately, these big affairs of the leaked diplomatic cables on WikiLeaks. Yeah, was this a good thing? Was this a bad thing? I think we are not, there's no consensus on that. And I think some people even say that the WikiLeaks led had an impact on the events in the Middle East. So that would in a sense serve Immanuel Kant's theory that transparency.
Yeah, we even talked earlier about. Both of those events vividly demonstrate in some ways the way that Kant's text is still contemporary in some way. You have the situation in Egypt, the question of a revolutionary society. You also have, since 9/11, you also have constant discussion of the state, the relation of the state to terror. Now, this is something that, in a sense, was precisely the environment that Kant was responding to, around the issue of what peace was within the fears of revolutionary societies and the fact that revolutionary societies can be out of control, that lead to, for instance, in that context, the French Terror, the period of terror in the French Revolution. But we, in the contemporary moment, don't know the limits of what will happen in the Middle East and whether, in a sense, that the transformations that will take place, whether they'll be revolutionary, cataclysmic, whether in a certain way fundamentalist. So in a certain, it's that insecurity that really defines the relationship. The WikiLeaks also, if you remember, one of the immediate responses from the conservative points of view were that any revelation of state secrets was a threat to national security and should be treated with prosecuted under criminal law. This vividly reenacts the very notion of censorship that Kant was addressing. That his own writings only a few years before when he wrote were censored. And one of the things he's appealing for in this document is that philosophers be able, whoever they are today, because there are no philosophers, when we speak of philosophers in the academic context, it's really only reducing the role of philosophy to one kind of institution, and I don't think that's what philosophy should be. Who are the theorists who are giving us notions of the future? They're not necessarily all located in the university. So, okay, so there are some visionaries, let's say, that don't, in a sense, get employed in the university. But the notion of secrecy or of transparency or publicity is very central. And so what Kant was seeking to protect was precisely the openness or the Öffentlichkeit, the openness of any knowledge of truth, but also the knowledge of the state, to open scrutiny, and it constantly appealed to that. So Kant would, in a certain way, in the contemporary context, would be on the side of those who, in a sense, leaked the WikiLeaks.
Yeah, I think Kant would clearly be on the side of transparency. I want to kind of maybe pose another question, but before I do that, I want to actually make an impassioned plea for you to listen to those recordings from the workshop at the IPI and many of the other recordings. There's an amazing moment when one of the ambassadors of a democratic country went on record as explaining that peace and democracy have nothing to do with each other, or at least they don't go well hand in hand if we want peace to mean something other than war. There are these remarkable moments of kind of candid and frank assessments of our own complicity in the institutions and the structures and the societies we're part of. I'm fundamentally committed to a dialogic practice, and the workshops in Beijing, for instance, or in Lahore were emblematic of that. But I guess this is a question for Greg, and because Martin's work is so much about cultural dialogue, also for Martin. But in Beijing, the workshops there took place at a government school. They coincided with Liu Xiaobo's Peace Prize award that week. Government inspections were taking place at the school. It was a complicated moment to want to have a contemporary discussion about peace. And
Aaron would email me and say, if I use the word you know I'm talking about, I won't have access to the internet for 24 hours too.
I think what's so fascinating about that moment was that these workshops were taking place at a moment when you can't necessarily talk about peace directly. And I don't think that would be specific in any way to Beijing. I don't want to be moralistic about that. What I want to see in that is actually something that's emblematic of when we try to talk about peace, the way that sometimes we're not able to instantiate immediately this ideal conversation in which everything is immediately made legible and translated. And so as the project went forward, as these workshops went forward, Greg and I had some very interesting discussions about cultural difference and translation. At the New Museum, Emily Apter, a professor at NYU of comparative literature, spoke about peace as an untranslatable word. And she talked about how peace cannot necessarily easily translate across languages and differences. So I guess at one point I had asked you, Greg, if you felt you could be implicated by what somebody in Lahore was saying in the recording, or what somebody in Beijing was saying, given that they had fundamentally at times different definitions or understandings. And I guess maybe I'm misreading you. Maybe this is just a provocation for the conversation. But I got the sense that you were less convinced of cultural dialogue, or you were maybe hesitant about thinking utopically about its possibilities. So I guess the question is, what does cultural dialogue mean to you? What does a dialogic practice mean to you? And do you think of it perhaps in the same way that I do, or do you take some issue? Like, what's the point of having the recording of the workshops from Lahore and the recording of the workshops from Beijing, for instance, near each other on the same page or the same website?
Well, I think that, this is something that, I mean, could bring in everybody, is that it's precisely what you said, that peace is not, it's not immediately a transparent concept because it's divided. And also it's not simply linguistic translation. It's also within these institutional practices, the practices of how we can not simply communicate. I think to think that communication would resolve anything is a mistake. So I think it's about a practice, about changing practices, that in fact, bringing these institutions together, but also bringing cultures together. The interesting thing about the workshops in right now in Chinese, and it's not to privilege in a sense. For instance, I believe that the very concept of the word peace is probably more repressed in the United States now than most places in the world, because in a sense it's a word that that is so contradictory to the practices of the official policies, as well as to the idea of the notion of peace. And I've argued this many times, as within our legal communities, as well as within within even our theoretical communities, the philosophical, has been replaced, I believe, by the notion of security. In other words, if you were talking about security, then you're talking simply about, in a sense, the power to make, in a sense, the power to secure, either through government or through a democratic process or through the military, the power to secure and to make safe. And so we live in a security environment today in this country. And I think that there are different forms of censorship operating and different kind of ideologies that are operating in China right now, where the notion of peace is often translated more openly by harmony. And that has a very definite relation to social harmony and to the meaning and to the policy of social harmony that is being adopted by the Chinese state. So in Korea, when I was there recently in Seoul, because we tried to engage in a workshop with universities in Seoul, and in fact in Seoul were prevented from doing so because of the recent eruption of the relationship between North Korea and South Korea, any discussion of peace would immediately be seen to be politically motivated, particularly when someone, a Westerner, or not simply a Westerner, but somebody from America would come in and engage in a discussion with academic as well as student representatives. So these moments of censorship and self-censorship, I think, are very prevalent. And what's interesting to me, it surrounds the very dismissal, the cynical dismissal of the notion of peace, as I have read it in many contexts, is a sign that it's being censored. The idea is being censored in some way. And that person being cynical about it is only reflecting an interest in some way to not consider the idea possible, that is, to negate it.
Yeah, I mean, I would also think that this idea of cultural dialogue is extraordinarily important. On the one hand, in the sense that cultural differences are the source of a lot of misunderstandings, and if you think of the misunderstandings that arise from the translation from the original German into English, in the title, you can understand that it's important to look at these things. I mean, Kant himself was clearly a universalist, and is often, like many other classical Western philosophers, accused of being a Eurocentric, and that this whole project of enlightenment was a Eurocentric idea, not taking into consideration other cultures. And I think that is important to take that into consideration. However, I think one should never go to the other extreme and for example, say values we believe in, like the human rights, that they are just basically culturally determined and not for everywhere. I mean, if you just look at not for everybody, if you just look at some of the arguments about the current crisis in Egypt, and when people say, well, democracy is good for us, but they're not mature enough, and it's not time, they need more time, and who are we to say, you know? And I think this is one has to be careful also with cultural relativism, that it's not used as an argument just for suppression and of what I believe are basic universal rights. And I think if you really look at the discourse that is going on, at least at the level of the United Nations, I think that there is a general consensus of the universality, at least of things that have been agreed on in the United Nations Charter, and that is basically the formula of human rights and the rule of law. And I think this is what Kant is arguing about. I mean, he's looking at the principles that need to be established in order to guarantee peace, and there needs to be some sort of universal agreement on these.
But it's not just temporary peace. It is always the eternal peace. That's the irony, or the real test case for Kant, is, in a sense, what is the mechanism, legal, cultural, political, and otherwise, that is going to bring about eternal peace? But I think that we've been talking quite a bit, so, I mean, we should, because I can see that eyes are starting to get a little heavy. So why don't we open up for some questions before we... Because you guys are going to be, ultimately, you're going to be engaged in this discussion too. And by the way, you're also going to be recorded and put on the web. So,
Kant had some interesting ideas about human rights. I recall reading near the end of his essay, he was talking about civil rights after his transcendental formula, which mentioned publicity. And he mentioned that if a people's rights have been injured by a tyrant, and no injustice comes to the tyrant, of which there is no doubt, he says, they are wrong to rise up in revolt or take arms against their tyrant. And here you're just mentioning how cultural relativism should not be used as a rationale for injury to human rights. And he also talks about, he kind of mentions the notion of sovereignty in his preliminary articles, saying that one nation should not interfere in the actions of the state of another. So I'm wondering, in a case like we have in Egypt, where actually the people have revolted against their government. He would still think that was wrong, would he not? And what would be done in that circumstance, according to Kant and according to your beliefs as well, part of the peace project?
That phrase that you talked about was one of the first articles. If you read Kant, he's being highly legalistic in his argument. He's avoiding the question of morality because he doesn't know how, at one point, what is the subject of morality here? It's not a political subject or a philosophical subject. But if you read that phrase, the question of should a third state or nation, first of all, if there's any war or civil war, it is immediately a Kant called it a return to a state of nature, meaning a state of violence, but also of lawlessness, because in a sense there is no order, or the order has been segregated in some ways. But he said that the nation would, in that case, even if it is a nation, would be cut in two. So the intervention into would inevitably be to take one side against another, in which case he said that what it would leave behind would be the indignity of, he said, a sovereign people against the offense of the intervention. So by the time you get to the end of that clause, he's completely undone the justification that any intervention, in a sense, would seem to be, one, not justified, and two, would lead to the worst consequences. And I think for Kant, and I think this is where he's very practical and historical, I think if we've seen historically the occasions where there is an intervention into civil war by another nation, it always leaves behind it the very memory of the oppressed, or basically the defeated party, the defeated group, that it could be centuries of memory of being offended that returns again in acts of war later on, in genocide and in other things that have occurred in the Balkans, as well as in other areas. So I think that one of the things that Kant talks about, if you look at his clauses, he's always undermining any moral argument that would be prescriptive. In this occasion, is it right to intervene? It's kind of interesting when he says, well, there is no state. There is actually two states, so you can't intervene. If a third state intervenes, it would be always on one side, choosing one side. So,
I would entirely agree. I think the point here is really to look at his principle of legality. I think it is true that if you read this text and compare it to international practice of today, we have become a lot more interventionist. I think that is our general understanding, that we think that, for example, if there is a humanitarian crisis, if there is an ethnic cleansing or a crisis of that magnitude, that the international community not only has the right, it has the obligation to intervene. And he stresses this principle of non-intervention, which is still a very important principle today in international law. And I think there is a tension between two different principles here. And I think the reason why we are more interventionist is also because we have evolved institutions in the international community that put a process of intervention, of legal interventions, in a kind of institutionalized way. Yeah? If you don't have those institutions, and whoever thinks that another country is doing something wrong intervenes, then you really have the seeds for war and for conflict. So I think
you got to remember, at Kant's time, there were not NGOs and non-state actors or agencies.
And there was no international criminal court of justice.
That would only be another nation or another prince intervening into to solve the war. Excellent question, though. Very good.
Another question?
I'd like to address this to the philosopher, but the Ian Kieber.
We're all philosophers.
Right. You were sort of nominated, particularly as the philosopher.
As you noticed, that I was set up, so I was the foil.
But all of you, I would be interested to get any of your input. But you used the term pilgrimage in a way that seemed very emphatic and intentional. And I'm curious for you to expand more on what you mean by that and what you mean by using that particular term with its certain charged religious history, and then perhaps say something about the part of religious institutions, particularly ones with long peace traditions that sometimes conflict with their equally long war traditions.
Right, right.
A historical caveat to that question is just the knowledge that the Crusades were originally conceptualized as armed pilgrimages to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was certainly speaking of it in an ironic way. We took a pilgrimage... We took a pilgrimage to the United Nations. So, if you know, we're doing a peace project.
You use that word.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So Aaron won't admit to that we did. No, it was in some way we felt that that engaging in this project that we were invited to go to Geneva, and so we felt, oh wow, this is a really great opportunity to actually engage in this. In this institution, to take part in the Human Rights Council and so forth. And in some ways, I was being kind of a little funny with the notion of it being a pilgrimage, because it had a special meaning of going to the origin of peace, right? You know, the origin of world peace. So that would itself be a little self-defeating and ironic, because what we found in Geneva is peace is a big business, okay? Peace makes a lot of money for Geneva. And if there ever was peace, all of Switzerland would be bankrupt the next day. Okay, so and now I'm not being just funny. I'm being very truthful. Because in a sense, there's interest, there's forms of commerce now around peace as well, and around those who sell peace or peddle peace, and those who profess peace. So it was a very interesting experience. In terms of the history of the religious institutions in the term, you know, there have been, of course, peace is the establishment Pax Romanum. In other words, it is the establishment precisely of a notion of peace that comes from a religious determination of final peace. So that notion of eternal peace always has an imperial and despotic sense to it. And I think that this is something that Kant was acutely aware of. I mean, a permanent peace is also the final death to the enemy. And so I think that the history of that relationship to religious institutions, I think in the Western religious institutions, but also it has that sense of the meaning of peace has a relationship to the establishment of belief. Or a belief of a total community as well. So we have to segregate or separate those meanings from the kind of project that we're invested in because of the kind of multiple institutions that we're engaged in.
I mean, the text doesn't talk about religion, and I think that could be also one of the weaknesses of the text, that it doesn't take religions nor does it take ideologies into consideration. It just takes as this one big guiding principle of reason and of nature that is going to guide the course of history and therefore the prospects of peace or war. However, I think that there is a lot of irony, but there is a sort of religious language in it, not only in an ironic sense. I think this eternal peace thing, then also the kind of way he talks about nature and providence going to make sure that peace in the end, that's kind of the same argument Christians would have used, that God would in a sense make sure that in the end everything would be well. So,
yeah, and I think that you have to read very closely, because he uses the term providence, which he takes from the Christian tradition that has been transformed from the Greek notion of fate, destiny, destination. But providence means that nature, there is a natural design, and that peace is the end of the design of nature, which he refers to as a great artist. So these terms are very carefully crafted in a way that he avoids the overt religious determination of saying the early theological determination of providence is that God has a plan for history, and the history will turn out with eternal peace. Whereas Kant, in a sense, takes the same narrative and situates it in a different framework. And I think that that's one that would be an interesting topic for your study as well as the workshops.
Kant wrote from a pre-nationalist perspective, so we weren't talking about any kind of nation state, but how does modern ethnic conflict play into the path towards internal peace? Because we're seeing now less state-to-state conflict and more ethnic interstate, intrastate conflicts, which wasn't really addressed in perpetual peace.
Well, I mean, the concept of ethnicity itself has a very historical relationship to how it emerged within political systems. But I think that if you see the role that historically states have had in producing ethnic conflicts, in other words, and this is partly what we talked about with the role of the intervention into civil disputes, the definition of ethnicity by state forms, by imperial forms particularly, for instance, the Roman during the period defined certain ethnic, created ethnic groups with it called politima, in the sense that these were defined by their customs or by what we today would call religions, okay, or by their beliefs, superstes, in other words, superstitions for the Romans. But in some ways, I think that it's a really important and interesting question, but it's fraught because the relation of ethnic conflict to state violence and state the history of the state forms within that region are so convoluted that I think that it's hard to separate them apart.
Yeah. No, he doesn't. He doesn't talk about nationalism. And I think that's one of the weaknesses one of the problems that has since come, and some people say that Enlightenment has contributed. I mean, romantic nationalism was in a sense born with Herder, who was a contemporary of Kant and who came up with all these theories of the nations. I think personally that he coming from a country, Austria, which really broke up because of such conflicts. The Austrian-Hungarian Empire was a multinational state, and so there are a lot of people, a lot of Austrian thinkers thought about that kind of problem. Does really a nation state need to be an ethnically homogeneous kind of state, which is in a sense a little bit the trend, which comes after Kant in the 19th century. And I would agree that this is a problem that needs that needed to be discussed and wasn't discussed enough in the century to follow Kant. And I wouldn't blame Kant for it. I would rather blame his the century that followed, in a sense. And that led to a lot of problems.
Yeah, but it does place in crisis the notion of could there be a universal cosmopolitanism, given the history now and the creation of different ethnic conflicts as well as the very identities that define the nature of what constitutes the cosmopolitan global system today. So I think that these would be very important questions for you to answer.
I'm kind of curious to see... hear what you guys see this project doing in the future, like in a place such as the Gaza Strip. How do you see this dialogue, if possible, extending to that type of environment? And also, I would just be curious to know what you guys believe is the vision of perpetual peace as described.
You're the innkeeper.
Okay. I've been kind of evading my speaking role for a bit, listening and enjoying that role of listening. The last few months I've been thinking very concretely with a colleague of mine who's also been part of this project, Eduardo Cadava, about a line in Marx, which is kind of fairly neglected. Marx at one point remarks in a letter, whoever drafts programs for the future is a reactionary. And so I'm interested in this other way of thinking about how things can play out and how the future arrives in whatever form it inevitably does. And so I guess thinking about that comment is somewhat related to your question. I want to say that I have a vision of where this project is going to lead, but that wouldn't be in the spirit of the project. The spirit of the project would be to see where the conversation leads informally each time, and to kind of just be true to that ethos and that methodology. So I'm pretty confident that the project will have a long life. What forms it will take and what institutions it will find itself in and what exhibitions will emerge, all of that is to be experienced, to be found out, to that'll emerge in this ongoing process.
Yeah, again, it comes back to this notion of publicity. And today, in order to be public, in order to make this project or a piece as an idea public, it takes many different forms. Because institutions today are incredibly closed systems. And I think the art and the cultural institutions are incredibly closed. Academic institutions are incredibly closed. And the political institutions are incredibly closed. So I think that, I mean, as you're talking about, it would be immediately relevant. What would it be like if we went to Gaza and tried to institute a conversation about perpetual... Well, at first, people would find it incredibly silly, okay, given the gravity and the history.
Maybe not.
Well, I mean, as you can see, we don't always agree. But it would depend on how we did it and what cultural institutions would actually envision what kind of conversation or what kind of public space should take place there. But us just showing up, three white guys in Gaza, you know, bringing the idea of peace, I don't think that would work out too well.
So. I mean, the idea of staging the project at the New Museum was a difficult one for me because as much as I'm involved in various cultural spaces and practices, I didn't want the project to be seen first and foremost as a kind of a visual practice, as a kind of a cultural initiative in that sense. And a museum is not necessarily the best space to have a discussion. A small kind of arts organization may be conducive to that, but a museum is a space of display.
But it reached a big public. I mean, yeah. The New Museum, the benefit was is that there was an enormous number of people, and we just felt like people were bumping into the targets on a daily basis. Mm. We also staged an initiative called the Peace Talks on the blue rug in one of the gallery spaces and brought people in to have... And it was a strange experience because basically there was a room with a blue rug in the middle of it and no other definition, and somebody would go and there would be a group of people sitting around on this rug and people would just start talking about peace, which seemed like a little bit of a performative, you know, kind of event. And in some ways, that's what it was supposed to do.
While I was in Tibet, of all places, I got this email from the museum explaining that they had just had these youth from Brooklyn who had never been in a museum before. And they had had a riot in the school the day before, and their first experience in a museum was that rug, and was kind of sitting in front of individuals that they had been very aggressively engaged in a fight with the day before and talking. And anyway, I say that because I don't mean to foreclose on the possibility of the public sphere or institutional spaces for these conversations, but I think what's so difficult about, for me, being in America right now, is that the public sphere is not always conducive to this conversations we want to have. And I felt that when I came back from Lahore. I wanted to have conversations, I still do, that I don't know that we're ready for, or that it would be so easy to have. There's just a lack of cultural understanding, I think. I know the conversations and the project will move forward, but I'm kind of fascinated by not knowing where they will play out, but knowing that they will. Right now, a colleague of Greg's, a colleague of mine, and I am in a conversation with her for a few months now. She'll be in Kigali teaching this summer, and so we're trying to think about how in Rwanda and elsewhere we can also be working on the project. It'll take a few months to emerge, but one aspect of the project that wasn't explained is even though we have these large institutional partners, it's not a project that's happened with a great deal of money. Not a great deal at all. We didn't actually receive any support from the Peace Institute or the UN. That's not what we asked them for. We asked them for their partnership in a different sense. So this is also a project that's happened through very informal networks and collaborative relationships, and we're trying to remain true to that, even if we don't necessarily acknowledge that through the public representation of the project. That informality is important to how we think.
It's a bit of the corporate fiction of our project. If you look on their website, it's like the United Nations is sponsoring this. You think that there's an enormous amount of money behind. No, there's not. We got the logo. That's what we got. So
we got more than the logo, but we didn't get
okay,
money.
Okay. But anyway, but we didn't get tons of money. Okay, so
but that's not what we're asking for. Yeah.
We are going to go to Amsterdam next year, and we're not getting loads of money from them either. But
he's paying for my flight.
Yeah, I'm paying for his flight. That's the truth. That's the truth of it. The gobs of money came from a few sources. So.
Maybe just one last comment on silly conversations that, as you know, in my ministry are called philosophical conversations. Now, I think yes, philosophical conversations in the Gaza Strip might not solve the problem, but I think philosophy is a necessary thing for all the people involved. I don't think we need to, with our project, make people talk about concrete conflicts. But I think those people who are already in this process in all kinds of different fields, I think for them it does make sense to reflect on what they're doing, on the language they use, and the ideology they use. And I just remember sitting next to the ambassador of Venezuela at the IPI conference, and it was a joy to discuss with him about a philosophical text and not about Hugo Chavez. And I think he enjoyed it just as much as I did. And I think breaking up these phrases and these conventions and these ideologies could be the solution for the Middle East conflict, but could create an atmosphere where people find it more easier to talk to each other.
Yeah, and just remember to be determined by conflict or by violence on a daily basis, to experience it on a daily basis, is something that not many in this room probably experience. But to be able to get distance from that determination is an important aspect of, I think, maybe one of the functions of the concept of peace is to give us a feeling of being distant from the violence that would determine, in a sense, our lives on a daily basis. So particularly for those who experience that sense of the immediacy of the lack of peace.
Are we supposed to end, or can we keep going?
If you want to take one more question, maybe.
Okay.
There's one back up here, yeah.
You described Hunt's paper as avoiding the language of morality, but in practical consideration of how to arrive at that type of peace, enumerated in the essay, isn't war essentially also guaranteed to be necessary to arrive at perpetual peace? And if so, isn't it our place to then judge wars, or even suggest a particular war happening? For the objective of peace, and does that take the form of morality or another factor?
The question of the ethical framework, which Kant, I mean, I'm saying that he tries to avoid immediately a moral determination of some of the questions that he raises. But in the footnotes, you'll see there's some really interesting passages when he talks about the cultural practices around war, for instance. For instance, celebrating wars, which is something that we do constantly, monumentalizing wars, monumentalizing war heroes, the heroic culture around war. There's a very interesting footnote, if you read in Kant, where he does bring a moral sense of shame around. He said, instead of celebrating a Memorial Day, for instance, the community should all turn up The ritual and the would should be one of atonement and forgiveness for causing so much death and suffering, rather than in a sense a celebration or an honor. And in some ways, you could imagine somebody writing that in the New York Times today, okay, would be completely lambasted by the fact that they were being unpatriotic, that they weren't honoring the soldiers and things like that. So I think that there is a moral sensibility in Kant's text, but it's not within the categories of how war he's more mechanical in determining how war and peace function. So.
This may not fully answer your question, but it reminded me of something that I was talking about last night in New York at CUNY, the City University of New York. I was in a conversation with a political scientist who I'd never met before, but whose work on Gandhi was quite fascinating to me. His name is Uday Mehta, and really extraordinary mind and a writer. And we had been engaged in a very interesting conversation about the degree to which Kant justifies, in a way, war by explaining that war nevertheless does the work of peace. It results in cultural mingling through the migration of populations that are dispersed on its account, and that even when war takes place, it nevertheless moves the conversation forward towards peace. So there's this very complicated way in which he justifies war at times in this essay, mm-hmm. As a way to move forward, towards a more peaceful series of relations.
Yeah.